very, very special guest today, Senator Johnny Isaacson. He was elected to the U.S. House of Representatives in 1999, served three terms, and in 2004 was elected to the U.S. Senate. He is up for re-election in 2010, a great patriot and a great American. Senator Isaacson, thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure, Ty. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure as well. I'm going to go ahead and dive right in. Are we leaving a better America to our children than was left for us?
Well, you know, I speak all over the state this past month since we've been home, and one of the statements I make is I don't want to be a part of the first generation to leave our grandkids worse off than our parents left us. And we are at a turning point in America in terms of debt, and we're a turning point in terms of taxes, and we're a turning point in terms of regulation. We have too much debt. The pending tax increases in a recession would be a detrimental to not only the short term but the long term. And we've got to get back to regulations that are fair but allow competition to dictate the winners and losers, not government.
I completely agree with that. Let me ask you this question. Do you think this is more of a fiscal problem or more of a moral problem?
Well, let's put it this way. It's morally wrong to mortgage your children and grandchildren's future. It's fiscally wrong to spend more than you take in. Most American families, mine included, in the last 2.5 years, have had to sit around the kitchen table and reprioritize their expenditures. We've all been going through difficult times. The American government ought to do at least what it requires of the American people to do. It's time to sit around the kitchen table in Washington, recognize how much we've got coming in, and not spend more than we take in.
I completely agree with that as well. Let me ask you this. What is your take on the Glenn Beck rally that took place this weekend? What's your take on all that?
I think there's a lot of evidence of the tremendous re-engagement of the American people in their government, and I think the rallies that you've seen of Tea Parties and some of the results of some of the elections at the polls and the grassroots, really the silent majority that Richard Nixon referred to almost 40 years ago. Americans are scared for their children's future. They're concerned about the direction the government's going, and they really have this Boston Tea Party mentality that they want to make sure that politicians in Washington and, quite frankly, in the states get the message. So it does not surprise me to see large turnouts at rallies like that.
Yeah, I thought that was that tremendous. And let's shift gears here just a second to the financial reform bill. I know that you were against that. You spoke out against that. And if you look at that bill, and I've personally done probably 30 or 50 interviews in the last month or two about that particular bill, we fixed things that weren't wrong, and we didn't fix what was wrong, Fannie and Freddie. And this bill is about more regulation, in my view, and more taxation. And there's never been an economy in the history of the world that has recovered as a result of more regulation and more taxation, yet we're doing more of that. Give me your spin on that.
Well, I debated Dick Durbin, the majority whip from Chicago, on the floor of the Senate late one night on this very point. He was talking about how we needed to bring Wall Street in line, and I just raised the point. I said, how can you say you want to bring Wall Street in line and then go exempt Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae from any scrutiny whatsoever while layering another layer of regulation over the community banking system? I was a community bank director for a number of years. I know what profit margins are in community banking, and quite frankly, the cost of compliance alone between Sarbanes-Oxley and the financial re-reg bill probably wipes out the profitability of a lot of community banks. It's way too much regulation and way too much government intervention. While the culprits that led to the cascading collapse in terms of finances a couple of years ago were Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae being the consumers of subprime debt and creating a market for what Wall Street did.
What should we do with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac right now?
You know, I don't think there's any. First of all, having come out of the residential real estate business, I've been through this type of crisis before. We went through it with the RTC when the savings and loans failed, and all of a sudden there was no source of mortgage money other than the government, and that's when Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac really came to the rescue. And for a number of years, capital formation by selling securities in subprime, but in traditional mortgage loans created a good cash flow into the mortgage business. What happened is the Congress, in particular Barney Frank in the House with his amendment, forced Freddie and Fannie to buy a portion of their portfolio to hold it in what he called affordable housing loans, but became known as subprime loans. And once that started and those started failing, it reduced the confidence in that type of investment, so there's not a lot less cash flowing in the mortgage business. We're going to have to do two things, not to give you a long answer, but the specific answer to your question. Freddie and Fannie have to be wound down over time. We've already put $141 billion into them. There's probably another bill approaching $700 billion that it's going to take before we clean that up. But once it's out of place, then I think we are going to have to replace it with a new entity that is a phase-out government-sponsored entity, much like what England did a number of years ago in terms of catastrophic insurance. They created reserve pools to back up insurance companies, so when there was a catastrophic loss, they had the cash in the bank to do it rather than depending on the taxpayers of England. We're going to have to do the same thing with mortgages in America.
Let me ask you this, and you kind of threw out some huge numbers, over $100 billion, and we're probably going to spend probably a great deal more to get Fannie and Freddie where they need to be. Question for you specifically: if you have your way, and you could cut anywhere you wanted to, we've run up the debt 30% in the last 2 years. We continue to spend more and more money. Annual federal deficit $1.6 trillion. I mean, it's ridiculous the amount of money that we're spending. If you can cut anywhere, where do you cut? Where do you start?
Well, there are two places. You have 2/3 of the federal appropriations are entitlements. That's Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, SSI, disability, veterans benefits, pensions for government employees, and 1/3 is discretionary spending. You cannot get your handle on spending unless you address both. From a standpoint of Social Security, for example, it's becoming unfunded by 2034, and that date's moving up every day. We're going to have to look at what Ronald Reagan did in 1986, and I'm a prime example of how you fix Social Security, because I was born in 1944. Reagan took the people born between 43 and 47, and he said, okay, your eligibility for Social Security is going to be age 66, not age 65. He pushed us out 1 year, and as you know, as a financial person, with the time value of money, you actuarially, that brought the system back into soundness. We're going to have to take a look at that again, because people are working longer, and we're going to have to see if the benefit needs to match the life expectancy of people and their working life in this country. That's one thing. Medicare, we're going to have some tough love on Medicare, and we're going to have to reward disease management and wellness and have consequences in terms of people not taking good care of themselves to get them aware of what they're contributing to the cost of Medicare. And on Medicaid, we're going to need to establish a co-payment system. If you've got a little bit of skin in the game, you tend to act a lot more responsibly than if it doesn't cost you anything to go to the emergency room, you're going to walk in, get your health care, and walk out. But if it's a $2, a $5 copay, whatever it might be, it makes you think twice before you do it. And I think we need to get that kind of responsibility into the Medicaid system. And then lastly, in terms of discretionary spending, what you could do to begin with is put an across-the-board cut that balances discretionary spending against debt, and then start going into an oversight where you review the existing programs of government, those that have been established years ago and might not be competitive now, and you begin one at a time to dismantle those and save the money that's being spent on them.
You know, as I look at Social Security, I'm 43 years old, and I don't think that I personally am ever going to see any Social Security. And as I talk to folks my age, they don't think so either. I'd be willing to just say, hey, the heck with it, and let me keep the rest of my Social Security money, invest it other places on my own behalf. Here's the question for you. We've moved that age back a few years. What age do we need to move that the full retirement age back to, or what range do you think?
I'm not an actuary, so this you're talking. I'm really a novice, but I know what they did for my age group. It may be another deferral of a year or 2 years. I don't know how much it is, but to make it actuarially sound without raising payroll taxes, you're going to have to push eligibility out. But you don't do it for those who are entering Social Security today. They've paid their fare. They deserve their eligibility. But you take people who are 25 years from their eligibility, and maybe you push that eligibility out a year or two, and that makes the system sound so you can count on. So we have an obligation, I think, in the country as the Congress of the United States and the executive branch to see to it the promises that have been made in the past are fulfilled. And if it means taking some tough medicine doing it, we're going to have to take some tough medicine.
All right. We're here with Senator Johnny Isaacson. We're talking about, are we leaving a better America to our children than was left for us? After the break, we're going to have a few more questions for the good senator, and we'll see you right after the break. All right, welcome back to the Ty J. Young Show. We are talking with Senator Johnny Isaacson, and the topic is, are we leaving a better America for our children than was left for us? And we've been talking about fiscally, morally, what are we doing? What are we doing to make sure, and we're going to go this way right now, what are we doing to make sure that our children get a better America than we inherited? And with me today, as always, I have my co-host, and they have a question or two for you, Senator, as well.
Look forward to it.
Senator, this is Steve Rodriguez. Thanks so much for being with us here today. Part about leaving a better America for our children means electing the right people. Can the Republicans take back the Senate along with the House? And what are your thoughts on whether or not the Bush tax cuts will get extended?
Well, Steve, in answer to the first question, the election is 61 days from today. And if you look at the generic poll, for the first time in history, Republicans nationally are polling at 51%, Democrats at 41%, and that's the generic ballot, which is a 19-point shift from 2 years ago. So the tangential evidence is that the party will make gains this November. The predictions right now, not from me, but from the experts, are that the House probably will go to a narrow margin Republican, and the Senate will probably go from 41 to 46 to 48 senators, which would be a significant improvement in terms of both houses.
Great. And real quick, just on those Bush tax cuts, what do you think you see happening in January when we come back into session?
Well, actually, what's going to happen the next 2 weeks, starting with the 13th of September, is going to be critical, because we can, in my judgment, you don't raise taxes in a recession, and it would be the worst thing to do. President Obama and Secretary Geithner have proposed letting the top two marginal rates go back to the old rate, raising capital gains to 20 and dividend to 20. I don't think in the end they'll be able to get the votes to do it, and it's my hope that we're going to be able to get an extension of 3 years on the existing tax rates so that they don't go back up. There's one addition we're going to have to deal with, and that's the estate tax, because December 31st at midnight, that tax, from what goes from being zero today to 55% of all assets over $1 million, which is an unconscionable amount of taxation. We have got to hammer out a compromise and fix the estate tax or the death tax for the long run. There are 57 of us in the Senate who have reached an agreement. That's three short of the number of votes we need to cut off a filibuster. But we've reached an agreement for a $5 million unified credit indexed to inflation. That'd be $10 million indexed to inflation per couple. A tax rate that's equivalent to whatever the capital gains rate is at the time of death, and all assets passing at the stepped-up value. That would basically eliminate the estate tax problems that Americans have for probably 98 to 99% of the American people.
Sure, and we deal with that every day in our business. I'm going to turn it over to David real quick. He has several questions, but one more follow-up. I apologize. The American people, do you feel it out on the campaign trail? It's not, I watch the Sunday shows, and it's frustrating when I see a lot of conservatives speak. It's not that Americans are opposed to taxes. It's that Americans are opposed to the way it's spent and wasted. Do you feel that on the campaign trail?
There's no question about it. America does not have a tax problem. They have a spending problem in government. And if we'll just start, as I said earlier, acting like the American people act, and that's prioritize our expenditures and not spend more than we take in, our children will have a bright future.
Thank you.
Hi, Senator David Nicholas. It's a pleasure to have you with us today.
Thanks, David.
I know you have 30 years' experience in the real estate market, and you spoke eloquently last year at the Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee about the need to actually extend the first-time homebuyer's credit. And it was a huge success. And I'm 23 years old, and I actually bought my first house back in April because of that credit, so I want to thank you for that. But now, after that credit's expired, what do you think it'll take to get the housing market back on its feet?
One word, jobs. I went through four recessions in my business career, 1968, 1974, 1981, 82, and 1990, 91, and they were all very difficult on the real estate business, but over time it recovered and housing continued to grow. This particular recession is unlike any we've ever seen since the Great Depression, because home values have plummeted in some areas, and even in the best of areas, those housings have lost their value, which has hurt access to credit for homeowners. It's hurt the value of a family's net worth. it's had a significant lack of confidence of the American people in the housing market, and the only thing that will bring it back is when people feel secure in their job and people that don't have a job get a job. So as I told some of the economic advisors to the president before we left at the first week of August for the August recess, I said, if there's one thing we can do and one thing only to get this economy in line and get the housing market back, it's get employment back. And that ought to be 24/7 focus of the Congress and the administration.
We're talking about, are we leaving a better America to our children? And we're here with Senator Johnny Isaacson. And as I look at history, I wrote an article to this effect. There's been three times where the economy has really been stimulated. We know exactly what works. JFK cut taxes, and it's okay for a Democrat to cut taxes. He did that. Tax revenue went up. The deficit went down. The economy grew and jobs were created. Reagan cut taxes. The economy grew. Jobs were created and tax revenue went up. And then George Bush cut taxes. The economy grew. Tax revenue went up. And jobs were created. We know exactly what it takes to stimulate the economy. We're just choosing not to do that. Why?
Well, you know, one of the problems that we've got in the Congress of the United States is there are not enough people in elected office who've actually been in business and run a business. Mm-hmm. A lot of people have come out of a lifetime career in government service, or they've come out of being a staff member to a former congressman, or they've come out of state government. There's not as much business experience as you need, because you hit the nail on the head. In Kennedy's administration, in Reagan's administration, and in George W. Bush's administration, when they reduced taxes, the first year after the reduction, revenues went up at a lower tax rate. And it did, because it motivated people to deploy assets, sell mature assets, and reinvest in new, eventually maturing assets to improve the capital investment of all the public. I mean, cutting taxes has a positive effect on spending, which has a positive effect on revenue, which a rising tide ends up lifting all boats.
All right. As we finish up here, question, if someone wants to make a contribution to your political campaign, how do they do that?
I have a website. It's johnnyisaacson.com. I have a Facebook page and a Twitter page as well, but they can get all the update information. They can contact us directly. They can donate online, whatever they might want to do, by just going to johnnyisaacson.com.
All right, sir. Thank you very much for being here. It's been an honor and a privilege to have you.
Thanks, Ty.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
All right.